That's Bob Marley and the Wailers with So Much Trouble in the World. It's from his 1979 album, Survival. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Thursday, January the 29th, 2015. And in his penultimate year in office, President Obama is a man on fire, snatching every bit of legacy he can get from a Republican-controlled Congress that has him marked for ignominy. Republicans were quick to dispute the great strides on the domestic front that the president had laid claim to in his January 20th State of the Union address, and were especially critical of his administration's foreign policy agenda. That's nothing new. What is new is Obama's clear intention to rebound from foreign policy missteps with a hands-on approach to deal-making and deal-closing that has netted him two impressive deals this year, Cuba and, as of this week, India. Is Obama truly on the foreign policy rebound? Diplomatic scholar, historian, attorney, and prolific author Dr. Gerald Horn answers the question comprehensively. Horn is the John Jay and Rebecca Morris Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He has written more than 30 books and more than 100 scholarly papers and reviews on struggles against imperialism, colonialism, fascism, and racism. His latest books are Race to Revolution, The U.S. and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow, and The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance, and the Origins of the United States of America. And I'm delighted to have you with us once more, Gerald. Welcome to Lead Stories.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Well, let's start with the big plum that Barack Obama seems to have plucked from the foreign policy tree this week, and that is India.
Well, you are correct. This is possibly as important a presidential trip as Nixon's trip to China some four decades ago. And in fact, the two are connected. That is to say, for younger people in your listening audience who may not know how China came to be ranked in 2014 as having the largest economy in the world by certain measures, including measures devised by the International Monetary Fund, the first time since 1872 that the United States has not been adjudged to have the largest economy in the world, therefore a trailblazing development. Well, one of the reasons, perhaps a central reason, that China was able to ascend to this position was that after Nixon journeyed to Beijing to talk with Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai, he helped to cement a trend that was already in motion. That is to say, what happened is that Beijing began to turn against its alleged communist ally in Moscow, and that helped to accelerate the demise of the then Soviet Union. China also, you may recall, when Deng Xiaoping, the paramount leader, came to the United States in the late 1970s, visiting Washington and Houston, Texas, amongst other sites, part of the payoff was that China then waged war on Vietnam. And then in return, you had this massive foreign direct investment in China that has helped to create this juggernaut. I might add parenthetically that there are those in your audience, I'm sure with gray hair, who would be sheepish to admit it, that they were all on board with regard to China's turn against the Soviet Union that's created this juggernaut, although you would think they claim parentage. I guess it worked out for them. China now has the largest economy in the world. But somehow they're as quiet as a mouse in a church with regard to that epical development. So now Obama, in January 2015, concerned about China and China outstripping the United States, he goes to India. And the idea now is to build up India against China. Mm. This is not only this nuclear deal, but it's also going to be massive direct foreign investment. The Japanese are also heavily invested in India. I recall when I was doing my book on India, The End of Empires, African Americans in India, which was published about 5 or 6 years ago. So about 8 or 9 years ago, I was in India. And one of the things that struck me even then was the significant Japanese presence in India, which is actually symbolized in perhaps the favorite car in India, the Suzuki Maruti, which is a combination Japanese-Indian vehicle. Interestingly enough, the ties between Japan and India stretch back 2,500 years to the founding of Buddhism. And interestingly enough, both India and Japan have very, shall we say, complicated relations with China. With regard to Japan, you'd say they're more complicated. But even with regard to India, you might recall that in October 1962, not coincidentally, as the United States and the Soviet Union were in a standoff over Cuba, China basically declared war on India, which was very depressing for the Indian leadership under Nehru. But it's not only Japan and the United States and India that are involved in this new encirclement of China. It's also Australia as well. You know that a couple years ago, Obama was in Australia establishing a U.S. base in Darwin in northern Australia to help to monitor China. So it's going to be very interesting how this unfolds in the 21st century. That is to say, whether this encirclement of India will prevail and whether, like the previous Nixonian policy, whether it will just basically mean that India will be the largest economy in the world, not China.
But Prime Minister Narendra Modi is a very wily man, and he's playing everybody to suit his needs.
Well, you know, another interesting thing is that the relations between Moscow and New Delhi are quite close, closer than lips and teeth, as said in that part of the world. You might have noticed in the Republic Day ceremony that Obama witnessed, which featured floats but also Indian military hardware. Most of the hardware was Russian hardware, quite frankly, including the jets, the tanks, the personnel carriers, all of the rest. Which actually helps to contradict the idea put forward by President Obama in the State of the Union address that Russia has been isolated with regard to Ukraine. That would not be the opinion in New Delhi. I would also say that's not the opinion in China. There was a very interesting cartoon in China Daily just a few days ago. That's the periodical published in Beijing. It showed the Russian bear in a cartoon at a campfire that was flickering and about to go out, rubbing his hands, trying to stay warm. And then he looks over his shoulder, and approaching him with a wagon full of logs is a Chinese panda, ready to throw logs from the fire. And that bespeaks this ever closer relationship between Moscow and Beijing. And just last year, as you know, one of the biggest commercial deals in all of human history was concluded between Moscow and Beijing over natural gas and energy, that might have been going westward towards European nations, but now will be heading eastward towards China. And China is all on board with regard to Russia's intervention in the Ukraine, because, of course, as China sees things, the intervention in the Ukraine, it's just a way to weaken Russia and to turn Russia into a forward base against China. So it's very interesting how the worm turns in history.
Well, the president made certain commitments to India, but amounting to several billions of dollars in trade. But even so, India accounts for only 2% of U.S. imports and 1% of its exports. So was this more symbolism than meat going on here in this visit to India? Did the president make a huge PR maneuver here, or is it going to amount to something more substantive?
Well, I think it's both. I mean, it certainly was huge PR, and certainly India has a steep uphill climb. You should also note that President Xi Jinping and the Chinese leadership have been in New Delhi as well, but for some reason, just before arriving in New Delhi, I think it was last year, the border dispute between China and India that stretches back at least to the October 62 war flared once again, which did not put Prime Minister Modi in a very good mood. But having said that, China plans to pour billions of dollars into India. In fact, China might be pouring more money into India than the United States does, even though the United States has a much more of a material and strategic interest in doing so. India has a steep uphill climb. Anyone who's been to India, I'm sure, will tell you that the poverty you see in India in some ways outstrips the poverty one sees in Africa, in West Africa, for example. The infrastructure is not very good, not only the roads, but the airports. However, what that tends to indicate is that India will now be benefiting from massive investments from all of the major parties in the world. I mean, India is like the belle of the ball now. Everybody's courting India. China's courting India because it's afraid the United States will enlist India in an anti-Beijing crusade. Japan is courting India for reasons already enunciated. The United States is courting India. The European Union is courting India. India is really in a very positive position right now, which obviously is flummoxing and irking its erstwhile antagonist, Pakistan, which is really descending into a kind of chaos, which is nothing new. But what's also interesting is that Pakistan has been the historic ally of China. That's been the lineup, that is to say, Pakistan and China versus New Delhi and Moscow. But now China is beginning to have second thoughts about Pakistan, although I don't think China would admit it for reasons I'm sure you can easily deduce. The line, the rhetoric is from China that the India-Pakistan relationship is sweeter than honey and harder than steel and taller than the Himalaya mountains and on and on and on. But in point of fact, China is concerned about these religious zealots that Pakistan tends to export in great number, not least because of its alliance with Saudi Arabia, which we can talk about, I'm sure, shortly. But also, China in the western part of China, there's a restive Muslim minority. One of the reasons why there's so much backsliding and hemming and hawing in Washington about fighting religious zealotry or fighting what some would like to call, quote, Islamic terrorism, unquote, it's because Washington is pursuing a double agenda. On the one hand, surely they would like to fight ISIS on the Syria-Iraqi border, that is to say the so-called Islamic State, or Daesh, as some call it. And certainly they would like to fight religious zealotry of that character in Western Europe, in Paris, even though it was curious that Obama did not go to the march a few weeks ago in Paris with other world leaders. But the United States is not above collaborating with these religious zealots in Western China, and they're not above collaborating with these religious zealots in Chechnya against Russia, their other stalwart foe.
Well, the president did cut short his trip to India to go to Saudi Arabia, and I guess this is as good a point as any to discuss the significance of that visit and the foreign policy objective with Saudi Arabia. As most everybody knows, the former king of Saudi Arabia died, and his half-brother, Salman bin Abdulaziz, is now the new king of Saudi Arabia. So what was the significance of that, other than saying a head of state paying respects to another head of state who also is an ally in the region?
Well, it was a show of strength in the United States' part. Not only did Obama and his spouse come to Saudi Arabia, but also a number of leading Republicans, including Senator John McCain, including former Secretaries of State Jim Baker of Texas and Condoleezza Rice, the two secretaries of state under the two Bushes, father and son, a number of congressional leaders, etc. Saudi-U.S. relations are very, very complicated right now. It used to be that the old deal was that Saudis exported oil to the United States and would take the proceeds and buy U.S. weaponry in the billions and would invest in U.S. Treasury bills that help to support the U.S. government, keeping the post office and the Pentagon open, and that Saudi investors would become major investors in Apple Computer, which they are, and in Fox, that is to say the Rupert Murdoch Enterprise, Fox News, the Fox Movie Studio, et cetera, New York Post. But things have become more complicated of late. I know you're in New York, so this may not be of major interest to New Yorkers, but in the rest of the United States, a major issue is the price of a gallon of gasoline, and it's plummeting precipitously. In the state of Texas, it's now about $1.78 in a gallon, which is amazing, since a few years ago it was creeping up to $4. This is putting more dollars in the pockets of U.S. consumers and is helping to revive the U.S. economy. Now, why is the price of oil falling? There are many scenarios, some of which involve Saudi Arabia. One is that the Saudis, at the instigation of the United States, are trying to drive down the price of oil by pumping more in order to wound Russia, Iran, and Venezuela. And by the way, Venezuela's economy in particular is really suffering grievously right now. It's something to keep an eye of concern on. A second theory is that the United States has become the world's leading oil producer, not least because of the shale oil boom in the state of Texas, and that the United States is flooding the market. And if the Republicans have their way with the Keystone Pipeline, the market will be flooded even further with the tar sands from Canada, which will make sure that the price of oil continues to go down. The other idea is that the Saudis are flooding the market and are actually to wage war against the United States, believe it or not, because they're concerned with the U.S. as an oil producer. They're concerned not only with that, but they're concerned in the long term with the rise of alternative sources of energy, such as wind and solar, which are not economical at, say, $45 a barrel, which is where we're headed to as we speak. Now, if the Saudis are waging that kind of war against the United States, that obviously complicates the relations, and certainly in the state of Texas, which is now about to go from boom to bust, as Governor Rick the Hairdo Perry steps down from the governor's chair in Austin to run for president, the Texas economy, which he brags about incessantly, is really suffering. What's happening is that real estate is plummeting. The oil companies and the oil services companies are laying off thousands of workers. Banks that have loaned money to these companies are now seeing their profits plummet. And there are a lot of Texans right now, Texas oil men, who are pointing the finger of accusation at Saudi Arabia, although you shouldn't rule out the possibility that the White House is waging war against the citadel of conservatism, which is Texas, which has been mighty arrogant of late because the price of a barrel of oil was only recently $100, and they were taking a lot of those profits and waging political warfare against the Democrats. But now, because Obama, you know, just, you might have noticed, just said that you can drill off the Atlantic coast of the United States, which is going to put even more oil into the market, which probably will mean a further drop in the price of oil. So it may be Obama waging war against Texas as opposed to Saudi Arabia waging war against Texas. I hope you're following all of these various scenarios.
But in the meantime, while all of this is happening, in terms of your analysis, many of the leading consuming countries are also backing away from the petrodollar.
Yeah, there's a very interesting book published by John Wiley, publisher, called The Colder War. I just read it. It's really all about that. His thesis is that going forward in the 21st century, the leading energy producer will be Russia. They're already the second or third oil producer. They're the leading natural gas producer, as you know, in the Northeast. A number of homes are heated by natural gas. Ditto for Germany. A lot of Germany's natural gas comes from Russia. with regard to nuclear, Russia is a major uranium producer. And going back to natural gas, Russia also has very good relations with a number of the African producers of natural gas, including Algeria and Mozambique. And so when you look at the current crisis right now, which is very serious, between Washington and Moscow over the Ukraine and the Crimea, the not-so-hidden agenda is this conflict over energy and whether or not Western Europe will become more dependent upon a strong Russia for its energy, which will help to create an alliance that was in motion before the spring 2014 in crisis in Ukraine. I'm speaking of a de facto alliance that was developing between Germany, Russia, and China, which is quite serious. Interestingly enough, the Ukraine crisis helped to disrupt that, interestingly enough. So the point you raise, the question you raise is well taken.
Well, just this week alone, Vice President Biden was heading up a summit of Caribbean nations in Washington around energy and looking for energy security, I think, is what the theme of this summit was. But really what it turns out to be is a way to persuade Caribbean nations to move away from Venezuela, to jam Venezuela up, as it were. But interestingly, Vice President Biden's son, Hunter Biden, who is, of course, on the board of directors of Ukraine's largest oil company, and in the business, this particular business is trading in natural gas. I'm sure there's obviously no connection whatsoever about trying to persuade the Caribbean nations not only to move away from Venezuela and its oil, subsidized oil to the Caribbean, which has been very, very important to the Caribbean, but to explore natural gas, which, of course, may just come from, should I say, someplace like Ukraine or somewhere. I'm sure there's no connection whatsoever there.
Well, you know, it's obviously very complicated. I mean, number one, as noted, Venezuela is under tremendous pressure right now. The currency is collapsing. President Maduro was just on a world tour. He went to China. He went to Saudi Arabia. He went to Qatar. And if you believe the U.S. press, he came back with empty pockets, although I don't necessarily accept that. But I do accept the fact that a number of grocery shelves in Caracas are empty. I accept the fact that some of the leading personalities in Caracas have flipped and have come over to the U.S. side and plan to testify against certain Venezuelan leaders and allegations concerning their supposed interest in drug dealing. I accept the fact that there is an ongoing destabilization campaign in Venezuela and that the United States would like to disrupt the plan that had been devised by former leader Hugo Chavez, whereby subsidized petroleum from Venezuela went to Caribbean nations, went to Central American nations and other nations. And I assume Vice President Biden's meeting concerned that very same question of, as you put it, jamming Venezuela. But interestingly enough, China plays a role in this. Perhaps since you follow Caribbean events, you can clarify or confirm this. I was talking to a friend who had been in Jamaica recently who told me that the Chinese have just finished a major road from Kingston to Montego Bay, and you can now drive in about 90 minutes. And this had been a road that had been started by French interests but had been dropped, and that China came in, paid off the French, built the road, and in return will be building hotels in Montego Bay. This is further evidence of a major Chinese pivot towards the Caribbean, and I would dare say that Vice President Biden's meeting with these nations is also an aspect of this concern about the Chinese pivot towards the Americas, including a pivot towards Trinidad and Tobago, excuse me, and other Caribbean nations. But in any case, have you heard that story about Jamaica?
Oh, yes. And not only that, they're about to begin a major dredging of several ports in order to allow larger ships to come in. And they are also buying up former sugarcane plantations in order to reignite the production of sugar in Jamaica, and particularly in Trinidad as well. But throughout the Caribbean, China has taken an extremely aggressive role. It is causing some trouble because they also are bringing their workers to these projects. And there's contention about whether these projects are providing enough employment for locals. So there's a bit of tension about that.
And just to clarify, I'm not sure if you've had this issue, but I know I have. Whenever one begins to speak at any length and depth about international affairs, certain querulous listeners begin to wonder, well, what about the United States? What does this have to do with the United States of America? Why are we talking about this? Isn't this a digression and a diversion? Well, let me point to an article that appeared in the New York Times this past Sunday, which I would recommend that all your listeners read because of its shock value. It's written by a liberal, a self-proclaimed liberal, by the name of Noam Scheiber, S-C-H-E-I-B-E-R, Noam, N-O-A-M. And what he says, he criticizes Mayor de Blasio. He says Mayor de Blasio has capitulated to, quote, identity politics, unquote, by sympathizing with the families of black victims of police misconduct, such as Eric Garner on Staten Island, for example, and that in doing so, he's disrupted the class coalition. He's disrupted the attempt to tax the wealthy. In other words, if you want to tax the wealthy, you can't express any sympathy for black people. And he criticizes President Obama because of the perception, we all know, he says, he suggests that perception is reality, the perception that the Affordable Care Act was more helpful to the poverty-stricken than others. Actually, Senator Chuck Schumer of your state of New York had made a similar argument some weeks ago, quite infamously, and that had riled certain members of the white working class and white middle class, because when you speak of the poverty-stricken, you're speaking about minorities, and they get upset when there's any sympathy towards minorities expressed. So in other words, if you want to build a progressive coalition, you can't express any sympathy for black people, or you can't even do anything for poor people, because many people interpret poor to mean black. And this is why we need international allies, because this was a liberal making this retrograde backwards argument, which shows you the nature of the correlation of forces in the United States right now, which are tipping dangerously to the right, buoyed by regressive trends from Europe, the tens of thousands that have been marching in Germany against Muslims, the fact that mosques have been torched in Sweden of late, the fact that there has been persistent harassment of Muslims in London of late. All of these winds are blowing across the Atlantic, and certainly those of us who are serious about progressive change have to recognize that history tells us that progressive change is more likely to come to the United States of America when we in the United States of America have a firm grasp on the international correlation of forces and a useful and formidable complement of global allies.
Let's turn our attention to another major stride that President Obama seems to have made, but people are watching very closely, and that is Cuba.
Oh, yes.
What is your position, or what do you see as the development with regard to Cuba right now?
Well, I think it's tied to our previous conversation. That is to say, concern about China's pivot towards the Caribbean. And if listeners think that China has developed a toehold in Jamaica and Trinidad, they will readily agree that China's developed a foothold in Cuba. Not only that, but China-Russia relations have improved dramatically under President Putin. And you may have been hearing all these scare stories of late about Russian bomber planes flying through the Gulf of Mexico, just like they've been flying through the English Channel and off the coast of Sweden. And there is growing concern about Moscow. And in Washington, there's growing concern about Russia's foothold and China's foothold in Cuba. And so I think that's the part of the news that quite typically the U.S. media did not bring out. The U.S. media state of the narrative is that Cuba's economy is collapsing. They're going on bended knee to Washington. They're ready to surrender all the fruits of socialism just to get McDonald's hamburgers, stands in Havana. And I think that's a bit one-sided. I think that from Obama's point of view, once again, you can see this as a way to disrupt the right-wing coalition. That is to say that once relations are established, and once American Express and MasterCard are established in Havana, and once General Motors starts selling cars there, and telecommunications giants start rebuilding the infrastructure there, it becomes very difficult for the Marco Rubio wing of the Republican Party to disrupt that relationship, assuming that the Republicans win in 2016. And in any event, it gets various wings of the Republican Party squabbling with each other, the pro-business wing versus the South Florida reactionary Cuban wing. And so from Obama's point of view, it was something of a masterstroke, because if his advisors are intelligent, I'm afraid they'll have to come to the same conclusion that I have, which is that the correlation of forces right now in the United States is tipping to the right, is tipping towards retrograde politics. And so what that means is that the progressives cannot outmuscle the right. Well, then you have to get the right fighting and squabbling amongst themselves so that they'll weaken each other. And that's effectively what this initiative with Cuba does. It gets the right wings, the wings of the right wing, squabbling with each other, forming a circular firing squad as they shoot at each other. And so that's another positive reason why this warming of relations is a good thing. Now, of course, there are going to be many bumps in the road. Havana has already made it clear that they expect a rapid evacuation of Guantanamo, that is to say, the U.S. military base on Cuban soil. That's good news for progressive forces, because we've been calling for an end to that obscenity whereby the United States scoops up mostly men from all over the world, but particularly from North Africa and from the Arab countries, and then brings them to Guantanamo to stay indefinitely, maybe forever. But if Cuba reclaims its territory, well, that will effectively end Guantanamo. And in fact, since Obama says that he wants to end Guantanamo too, there might be some maneuvering that is not apparent on his part with regard to that issue as well.
Well, interestingly, President Raul Castro just yesterday at the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States Summit in Costa Rica said not only the return of Guantanamo Bay and the lifting of the embargo on Cuba, but he also used the R word, reparations, for damages that were suffered by Cuba during, of course, the embargo against Cuba. What do you think is likely to be President Obama's response to that?
Well, first of all, that's music to my ears, because one of the reasons I wrote my book on Cuba, which deals quite a bit with the role of U.S. slave traders going into the Congo River Basin, going into Mozambique, enchaining Africans, dragging them across the Atlantic to Cuba. One of the many reasons why I wrote so much about that issue is because I wanted this to be ammunition that the reparations movement in the United States could use to make overtures to Havana for a joint campaign for reparations against the authorities in Washington, and I should also say New York, since New York banks were the financiers of this violation of human rights. So that is good news that President Raul Castro was talking about reparations. Now, obviously, it complicates life for President Obama, Because, as you already know, those in the Republican Party who do not feel that he's a secret Muslim feel that he's a secret communist. They point, in fact, to his memoir, Dreams of My Father, where he talks about this character, Frank, who he doesn't give his surname, but as has been revealed, this character, Frank, who is a major black male figure in his life growing up in Honolulu, was actually Frank Marshall Davis, who was a leading black communist in both Chicago and Honolulu, who I write about in my book, Fighting in Paradise, Labor Unions, Racism, Communism, and the Making of Modern Hawaii. So this initiative of President Castro for reparations is not going to be received, I think, very warmly in the White House.
Well, nor would it, but it will provide great ammunition for the critics, both of the rapprochement with Cuba and critics of President Obama as well. I'm talking about the Marco Rubio crew.
Yes, definitely Marco Rubio, because he's going to need some arrows in his quiver because he plans to run for president, and Jeb Bush is basically going to lock down most of the big money in Florida, since Jeb was formerly governor of Louisiana, and Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, who happens to be of Cuban descent as well, and makes Marco Rubio look almost like a Marxist, since Cruz is so reactionary. I mean, he's bizarre. He's off the charts. He's off the chain. And so Marco Rubio is going to need some arrows, and this issue that we're talking about could provide him with some breathing space.
We have a little bit of time, enough to address a major development this past week, and that is the election of one of the youngest heads of state in the Mediterranean, and that is Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras, who has been causing a lot of grief in a way. A lot of triumph, but a lot of grief, because he intends to upend the era of austerity. Could you talk about that?
Well, buckle your seatbelt. It's going to be very interesting. I mean, Greece, of course, resonates with U.S. foreign policy. You might recall that it was in the era of President Harry Truman in the late 1940s that in many ways the turn against the Soviet Union that theretofore had been the ally of the United States from 1941 to 1945, that era effectively ended when the left in Greece, which historically has been quite strong, was pushing towards power, and Truman and the United States intervened on a muscular level to prevent that from happening, which in many ways was the opening shot in round two of the Cold War. Round one, of course, beginning in October 1917 with the Bolshevik Revolution. Now, with this recent election in Greece that just took place a few days ago, with a left-wing government coming to power that pledges to upend austerity, interestingly enough, just yesterday, Mark Carney of the Bank of England, who happens to be Canadian, by the way, he agreed that austerity has not been working, which is quite remarkable. Coming from Mark Carney, who came into office during the administration of the Tory Prime Minister David Cameron, who of course is one of austerity's best friends and biggest champions, but also because the Bank of England historically has been something of a toady to the Federal Reserve in Washington. So I was quite struck by that remarks. I don't know. I mean, I assume that he was out of line and that he'll retract his remarks or he'll have a train accident or something like that rather shortly. But in any case, it's indication of the upset that has been caused by this Greek election. A second point with regard to the Greek election is that the European leadership is meeting today as we speak about further sanctions against Russia over the Ukraine. My understanding is that it has to be unanimous amongst the 24+ EU member states, and the Greeks have suggested that they're not on board with regard to further sanctions against Russia over Ukraine. which could be quite disruptive. Number three is that, once again, China has major interests in Greece. And indeed, if a relatively small country like Greece, perhaps 11, 12 million at most, is able to buck the EU bureaucracy in Brussels, buck the Germans, buck the International Monetary Fund, buck the Yankees in Washington, they're going to need a backstop. And that backstop might turn out to be Moscow and Beijing. Given the fact that before the unfortunate Charlie Hebdo incident in Paris a few weeks ago, President Hollande of France was also talking about moving away from sanctions against Russia, Italy has been talking along the same line. So what we could be talking about is an impending rupture and rift in the European Union that could deepen further as parties of the left, such as Podemos, we can, in Spain, gain more influence and power, as I'm sure they will. So it's going to be a very interesting chapter to see unfold in light of this Greek election.
One of the curiously missing, and it's most significant missing, in the discussion about what's going on with U.S. foreign policy is Africa. Mm. What is going on with U.S. foreign policy and Africa?
It's gotten bogged down in anti-terrorism. I mean, obviously, as Obama, I'm sure in his memoirs, will admit, perhaps the most significant blunder of all of his years in office was that ill-fated, ill-advised invasion of Libya or bombing of Libya in 2011. It's unleashed a tidal wave of religious zealotry, not only in neighboring Mali, which, of course, as you know, led to a direct French intervention, which continues, but also has destabilized Niger. You may recall that after the Charlie Hebdo episode in Niger, you had a number of churches that were burned. Same thing happened in Nigeria. It's given a shot in the arm to Boko Haram, which in many ways has established a caliphate akin to the Islamic State caliphate, so-called, on the Iraqi-Syria border, except that Boko Haram's caliphate might be larger. It might even be larger than the size of Belgium, for example. And this is taking place in Africa's largest economy. I'm speaking of Nigeria. And with an election about to unfold in a few weeks that could lead to the displacement of the president incumbent, Goodluck Jonathan, and could stir even more unrest. U.S. interest in Africa is mostly based upon anti-terrorism and the extraction of basic commodities, commodities like copper, for example, not so much oil as it used to be because of our previous conversation, you may recall, about the United States now becoming the world's leading oil producer, but platinum, diamonds, et cetera. That's basically where Africa stands in terms of U.S. foreign policy.
But still, two states stand out. I mean, we are clear about the issue of Boko Haram in Nigeria, but South Africa and Zimbabwe in particular have occupied specific attention lately. Why?
Well, Zimbabwe, because, as you know, relations went south some years ago, after the ZANU-PF ruling government expropriated the land of farmers belonging to the European minority, which it seemed to me stirred fears in many of these other settler states, not least the United States of America, that their ill-gotten gains established under white supremacy and colonialism too could be appropriated. That led to sanctions against Zimbabwe, but Zimbabwe, once again, it turned to China, which has become a major force in the Zimbabwean economy. President Robert Mugabe will celebrate his 91st birthday in a few weeks. Shows no signs of stepping down. And in any case, at the recent party Congress, his wife, Grace, seemingly has been primed, perhaps, to take his place if somehow he exits the scene. And in any case, a number of alleged heirs to Mr. Mugabe, I'm speaking of Joyce Mujuru, who had been vice president until recently, until this party Congress, have been purged. But I do think that there might be signs that there could be an upswing in Zimbabwe-U.S. relations. I don't think it necessarily happened under Obama because, for reasons I'll leave for the historians to sort out, Obama does not want to put any red flags in the face of ultra-white supremacists. And improving relations with Mugabe, who took land from white farmers, is the reddest of red flags. So I could see some subterranean improvement in relations, but we'll have to wait for a melanin-deficient president to arrive in November 2016, perhaps, for relations to improve. Now, with regard to South Africa, the U.S. relations with South Africa are proper and correct. The United States is not happy with South Africa joining the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, which is seen as an alternative power center to the North Atlantic Alliance, which actually happens to be true. Interestingly enough, for those who have been concerned about the African National Congress government not moving rapidly enough on issues like land reform, perhaps because they saw what happened to Zimbabwe when it moved on to land reform, well, just the other day, the ANC proposed that farmers who were mostly big farmers who were mostly white would be limited only to 12,000 hectares, and that's a lot of land, but there are many white farmers who own substantially more than that. That's going to cause outrage amongst the European minority, and in fact I think historians of the future will be dumbfounded by the fact, as I am dumbfounded now, that when there's discussion of South African politics, understandably, there's oftentimes critique of the ANC government, but it's almost like the 10% of the South African population is of European extraction. They're mostly votes with the right wing. It's like they're not part of the equation. I mean, they're still there. They're still allied with the North Atlantic powers. They're still throwing roadblocks and stumbling blocks in the path. And you better believe that their hair is mussed. The government, particularly the government in Washington, will be roaring in outrage.
So if you were to make a very quick prediction as we come to the end of the program today, what would you see as the hot spots to keep an eye on in the, let's say, in the coming week or so?
Oh, well, you know, those are typical. Pakistan, of course, to begin with. You never can go wrong by saying Pakistan will be a hot spot. But I would also keep a close eye on Saudi Arabia. I don't think King Salman, the successor to King Abdullah, I don't think he's long for this world. I understand that he has dementia or perhaps Alzheimer's. And with 7,000 princes battling for influence, there's all sorts of scenarios that one can stretch a sketch for a royal intrigue. This taking place in a major oil producer with most of the oil produced in the eastern part of the country, which has a substantial Shia population, even though Saudi Arabia is a mostly Sunni country, with the Shias perceived at least as being close to neighboring Iran, with which Saudi Arabia is in a Cold War with, which brings us to Yemen. The historic idea in Saudi Arabia is that their national security is based upon stability in Yemen. Yemen is now decomposing. Once again, the Houthis, who are seizing power, are close to Iran. That's one of the explanations for that major league delegation led by Obama that was just in Saudi Arabia in the last 48 hours. So keep your eyes carefully on Saudi Arabia. And I'm afraid to say Venezuela. The United States is bringing down the hammer on Venezuela. And it's very unfortunate to see, it's very unfortunate to witness. If that Maduro government is weakened further, it's going to mean more pain to Caribbean nations, particularly nations like Haiti, which are dependent upon subsidized oil from Venezuela. So as of now, those are the spots I would point to, although if I had more time, I could go on in this vein.
Well, we have to arrange your return as soon as possible to follow up. But we've come to the end of the program today. I want to thank you so much, Gerald, for being with us and always, always being so insightful and informative and putting these issues in a way that is easily accessible to anybody listening. Thank you so much for that.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. We've come to the end of our program. Keep it right here. Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Doust will be next. And you can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com and on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Always a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. See you tomorrow.